Hello and welcome to the Opening Bell, the Boxing News Podcast. Yet again, apologies for the little break we've had.
But we're back, that's the main thing.
We are back. We haven't been doing nothing in the interim, but we're back for a podcast. So there's been a lot going on. Sorry, my name's Matt Christie, editor of Boxing News. Alongside me is online editor John Dennan. There's been lots going on, so we've got lots to talk about. I've got this week's issue in front of me, which kind of nicely does kind of talk about most of the events of the last few weeks, actually. And on the cover, it's really split opinion, our front cover this week. We've got Kell Brook on the front, the headline, with a nod to his courage, with a nod to his Sheffield roots, Balls of Steel. Now, this is, of course, because he has accepted the challenge of the very, very promising indeed Errol Spence Jr., his IBF welterweight mandatory challenger. There was talk that he would take on Amir Khan, which has kind of developed into the British version of Mayweather-Pacquiao, will they, won't they, what have you. The talks were ongoing, they're extensive. Ultimately, they didn't come to fruition, which isn't a huge surprise. So after his foray up to middleweight to take on Gennady Golovkin, and there was a lot of talk in the lead up to that he was a lot happier with the weight. It's no secret that he struggled to make welterweight. He is going to go back down to welterweight and take on Spence Jr. Now, some of the criticism we received regarding this front cover was the fact that why should Brook get so much credit simply for taking on his number one contender? However, you look a little bit deeper and it's an admirable thing he's doing, and I stand by that. What was your reaction, John, when you heard that the Spence Jr. fight was agreed?
Yeah, I'd agree that it's Kell Brook's to be applauded for taking the fight, because you would have thought that Brook was in a position to chase bigger names, and the fact that he'd been up to middleweight and it was generally thought physically he'd be better off at super welterweight, his days at 147 pounds could have been behind him, and he could have been there to hunt. Obviously there were failed negotiations with Khan, but there's some pretty big names floating around at light middleweight, and his life could certainly have been easier. So yeah, I'm impressed that he's taken the fight, because you couldn't have knocked him for not fighting Errol Spence, because it would have been very easy to think it's too hard for him to get back down to welterweight, and you can't really fault his courage because he has been in there with Gennady Golovkin. I suppose his view on the Golovkin fight was everything to gain. In this case, against Errol Spence, really hard fight, and he's got everything to lose.
Will he lose?
I think it's a proper 50-50 fight, because Brook has been operating at a higher level than Errol Spence has, but Spence has done everything right and he's looked really destructive. I think before Brook fought Golovkin, I would have picked Brook. Now I'll pick Errol Spence to win, because I think it's going to be really hard to go all the way up to 160 pounds and have a very tough physical fight, and then have to get all the way back down to 147 pounds. I remember seeing Brook at a press conference before the Jojo Dan fight or something like that. Obviously a fight that he ended up winning easily, but I just thought he didn't look, he just looked so gaunt at 147, and I just think it's going to be even harder to make. And I think Spence is very skilled and powerful as well. So I think this is it's definitely a losable fight.
I think it really is. I think if you take a closer look at Kell Brook's record as well, obviously the standout win is the Sean Porter title win on a Wasaw, which was a fantastic result, and I think underrated by a lot of fans. But then after that, you can point to the Golovkin performance as a good performance, but ultimately he was stopped, and ultimately he was convincing. It was a convincing defeat in five rounds. And you look at what Errol Spence Jr. has done. He's, if you just take his two most recent bouts against Leonard Bundu and Chris Algieri?
If anyone can get past Chris Algieri,
there's stoppage, two stoppage wins, which you could argue are more impressive than Brooks' wins that have come since Sean Porter. I think you could make a good argument for that.
Definitely.
So, you know, how... But the flip side of it as well is, and I've seen also looked on social media, and I've seen some people kind of saying this could be Kell Brook's Jeff Lacey moment, in that, like Joe Calzaghe did all those years ago, he'd kind of built a successful career, but he hadn't really received the credit. He hadn't really had that opponent to prove himself against. And you can make parallels with that, in that Jeff Lacey came over very much, was... By many people, including Boxing News at the time, was thought to he was going to be the winner. Yet he was completely exposed. Lacey, as it turned out, it was Joe Calzaghe that had all those different levels to go to, and Lacey had nowhere to go. Is there a chance that this could be Kell Brook's coming out moment, and this is where, because let's be fair, he does split opinion.
This
could be the moment where he's like, yeah, I've done it, look at what I've done, and he turns in an absolutely fantastic performance.
Yeah, I mean, because he is levels above Bundu and Algieri.
Of course he is.
And he's been operating as someone who, after Gennady Golovkin, Errol Spence isn't going to really compare to that. So he has been sort of operating at an exceptionally high level as well. So yeah, he could just be too skilled and have too much for Errol Spence. But I think it's a proper fight, and I think it's hard to predict, and that's part of what makes it good.
I mean, other people said, I mean, you touched on it earlier on, other people's opinions has been that, well, he was clearly wanted the Khan fight, which of course he did, so he had nowhere else to go, he had to take the Errol Spence. But that's not strictly true, is it? I'm sure there's numerous places he could have gone. The super welterweight division, or light middleweight division, as I prefer to call it, there would have been, I'm sure, numerous fights he could have taken there, perhaps not at world title level, but in the short term a tune up and then set up a big fight with even, you know, Cotto was being rumoured, there was these kind of opponents. Well, that
Cotto
were there.
Needs an opponent now. Kirkland's out the running. Pacquiao doesn't seem to be desperate to fight Jeff Horn, not that he's afraid of Jeff Horn. That
he's terrified
Pacquiao.
Of Jeff Horn. It's clear to me.
But exactly, Pacquiao hasn't like signed on for Jeff Horn. You know, and Brook is a
But there was certainly other options for him to pursue. It's not like he was backed into a corner and the only person facing him was Errol Spence.
Yeah.
He could have done other things, and I think fair play to him. And I remember speaking to him just before the, I think it was probably 10 days before the Gennady Golovkin fight, and a lot of talk of that was weight. You know, it was very much this kind of Superman mission. He's going up two weight divisions. But it was also clear that he looked a lot happier without having to boil himself down and everything else. And kind of the question that I remember posing to him was, well, why did you not make this move sooner? You've clearly not looked good on the scales. Not saying he hadn't looked good in the ring afterwards, but you've clearly not looked good. Almost looks like he's making himself ill to go down in weight. But he said, well, look, you know, I could see that I was working my way up the welterweight rankings. It had taken me a long time to do that. Then I eventually managed to get the number one spot in the IBF rankings. I wanted the title. Then I won the title, and I wanted to stay there and defend the title. That world title clearly means a lot to him. And I think that's something else where we should perhaps give him a bit of credit, because it is too easy in this day and age of titles to just kind of ditch one, then move on to the next, and kind of manoeuvre yourself around. So you are kind of, you are not taking on the easiest challenges, but some might say that you'd be avoiding your hardest ones. And you could aim that at certain champions, many, many champions over the years. And Brook, I think, is bucking that trend. And I think, as I say in the column this week, for boxing to truly flourish, for boxing to be as good as it can be, the champions have got to define themselves by proving they're the best in their division, and by doing this, Brook is giving himself a chance to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's you know, the signs are good for 2017. We're getting good fights made.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look at how we started. I mean, it's easy to kind of jump on the whole the bandwagon and criticise boxing, but I think even boxing's harshest critics, and the harshest critics of boxing tend to be its biggest fans very often, and I think it's understandable in that over the years we haven't always got what we've wanted. But if you look at the two main fights that we've seen so far this year, the first two, we've got James De Gale against Badou Jack. We've also had Carl Frampton against Leo Santa Cruz. And there were two fantastic spectacles, two great advertisements for the sport, and it shows what happens when fights are well matched. We'll move on to the third big fight that we've had this year, which was Chris Eubank against Reynald Quinlan.
How was it, Matt?
Well, as an event, it was fine. I thought there was some interesting things on the undercard. I didn't think the main event was offensively bad. It was clear. It was very one-sided. Certainly, still a little bit puzzled by the whole pay-per-view. Let's put this on pay-per-view. Still haven't got a definitive answer on exactly how many people bought it.
Do you think we'll get a number from ITV?
You would hope so. You would hope so, and the longer that you don't, the silence is deafening, isn't it?
Yeah. And if this one hasn't done well, are we like, you know, what does that mean for boxing on ITV?
The noises that they were making beforehand was that it doesn't matter what numbers this, you know, it doesn't matter what numbers this does. We've got this new technology. We're going to try it out. If there's any teething problems in this one, then we'll make sure it's right for when we do a bigger fight. And there clearly were teething problems, which hopefully will be resolved. I don't think there was no indication that this was a one-time only deal. But whether ITV have been convinced to continue, we can't say for certain, because there hasn't been an official comment on that. But I would say, as I said beforehand, if that had just been an event that was on ITV4, that would have been perfectly acceptable. I think the whole Eubank story, whether you love them or hate them, has got enough gravitas to draw people's attention in.
On terrestrial TV, a Eubank fight would be massive, wouldn't
it? Yeah, I think the undercard was hurt by Joseph Agbiko's very, very late pullout, but
it seems like it's a pretty good undercard.
It was, despite that. Yeah, I thought the Ryder Etches fight was decent.
The Welsh Bruce Lee.
Well, yes, and the David Price fight, as harrowing as it was to watch. From looking at it as from David Price's point of view, or rather not his point of view, but his fans' point of view, it was a dramatic heavyweight fight.
And an unexpected.
Pardon?
Him losing was unexected as well.
I don't know.
Feared, maybe.
Yeah, you had to make David Price the favourite going in, but given his history... There was always that concern that something like that would happen. But I remember I spoke to Scott Welsh literally about half an hour before that fight started, and he didn't have a shadow of a doubt in his mind. He said, if you know heavyweight boxing like I know heavyweight boxing, and the talent level that's there, and the skill that's here, David Price should win this, and he should win it convincingly. Because let's face it, on paper and everything else, David Price, you thought was levels above Christian Hammer.
Yeah.
And it became quite difficult to watch. I mean, there's something really interesting in this week's issue, that if people haven't seen it yet, I'd advise you to go out and find it. We've got a page with David Caldwell, who goes into detail about the build up to the David Price fight. Caldwell, of course, was criticised as well. Number one, because of David Price's weight, the fact that he appeared to be absolutely knackered after three rounds. And Caldwell goes into detail about all that. But it was... I mean, what is could you see any way back now for David Price? If David Price, because he's, you could imagine that he's going through absolute hell.
Yeah.
Reliving that moment.
You know, it's hard to say never, especially in heavyweight boxing. It always feels like you're one sort of heavyweights, one spectacular win away from a big fight. But I think this loss is so much harder to come back from than his previous defeats. I just don't know.
Yeah, no. I mean, he's genuinely known in the industry as being a tremendously nice fellow. He's articulate. He's wise. And had he have come through this, had he have looked good in this, then I think, yeah, okay, the ball is well and truly rolling again now. But the nature of his collapse, it does suggest that his future lies elsewhere. He's not young. He's not a young guy anymore. Was he 33, 34?
What, 34 is not young? What?
And as much as I'd like to see him succeed, when you see fighters' careers go like this, I can't think of an example where someone has turned it around from such circumstances throughout history.
You don't want to see David Price suffering another of these knockout defeats. I mean, you've been ringside for more than your fair share of David Price losses.
Yeah, it is exceptionally difficult to see, because you also know how much he wants to win and how much it means to him. But there's a future for him, as I mentioned in the column a week or so ago. There's a future for him in boxing. Because he'd probably make a fantastic trainer, as someone to use in broadcasting. He'd be a wonderful addition to any team. So I'm sure there is a future for him. But I just imagine that this kind of stage for him now, where he is ultimately having to probably admit to himself that there's no coming back from this, must be extremely, extremely difficult.
But it's not been a bad career. It's not been as good as the potential.
No. Exactly. I mean, he's got an Olympic
bronze.
He's got an Olympic bronze, and in the pros, he got the British title, the Commonwealth title. But I think it's just that momentum that he built up, and the expectation suddenly went through the roof. I remember the start of his professional career, maybe the first 10 fights, there was a few question marks there, and then all of a sudden it started to come together for him, and he was blasting out. Matt Skelton,
Sam Sexton,
Audley Harrison, and I remember being there watching that fight against Audley Harrison and the manner in which he took Audley Harrison apart, and I was just convinced. I was convinced that he would go on to be to at least compete at world level. I remember even Vladimir.
He was sparring really good people.
Yeah, even Vladimir Klitschko was saying this is the guy who's going to take over from me.
Klitschko always says that.
He says it a lot. He said it. Yeah. He said it about a few people, hasn't he? So anyway, what else are we going to talk about? So we've done.
What's on your mind,
mate? We've done Kell Brook. We've done Eubank, we've done David Price. What else should we talk about? What about Ricky Hatton?
Let's talk about Ricky Hatton.
Okay, Ricky Hatton has worked with Zanat Zakiyanov.
Easy for you to say.
Not really. Let's call him Double Z. For, I think, since 2011, initially as a manager or promoter, and then he kind of took over training duties a couple of years after that. He worked really, really closely with him. Ricky Hatton's problems outside the ring, well documented, don't need to be spoken about here, but there's obviously no debating the fact that he's had some problems in retirement, Ricky Hatton. And Double Z, an underdog against Roushey Warren, fair to say.
Yeah, an underdog who had a terrible start in the fight.
Unbelievable. Yeah, two knockdowns he suffered in the first round, and you can only imagine what was going through Ricky Hatton's mind when all that was going on. But in Hatton fashion, really, he was tenacious. He got himself back in the fight, and he almost broke Warren's heart a little bit, I sensed. We speak to Ricky Hatton in detail in this week's issue. And he kind of goes through the whole process. But what a journey for these two. And Ricky Hatton has often been, when we look at the best fighters in the country, there's certain names that roll off the tongue straight away. You're Adam Booth, you're Joe Gallagher, you're Shane McGuigan.
Best trainers.
Yeah. But Ricky Hatton is never ever mentioned. But you look at what he's doing, he's quietly building a potentially very, very good stable of boxers up there.
For someone as famous as Ricky Hatton, he's a surprisingly low profile trainer.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, I didn't even realise he trained Double Z.
Yeah, yeah.
Let alone he was about to train a fighter to a, you know, he's about to train his first fighter to a world title win. I mean, he's sort of done it all now.
Well, this is kind of what,
for all his ups and downs, as a fighter himself and as a promoter and now as a trainer.
Because it has been a difficult road for him. I mean, he was involved quite heavily as a promoter with Sky Sports, and it just looked like he was going to go on. He was going to kind of emulate. I remember he was the British version of Oscar De La Hoya, wasn't he? He was going to go on and emulate De La Hoya over here, and then Sky moved on and just used Matchroom as their sole promoter, and Ricky Hatton really was one of the casualties of that, and that must have been very, very difficult for him to take. He obviously had a strong relationship with Adam Smith, and on a personal level and a professional level, it must have been difficult. In all that, he had his, during all his time as well, he came back into the ring, which was kind of an ill-advised comeback with hindsight. Again, that was when it was absolutely confirmed to him that his boxing career was over. That would have been extremely difficult to cope with, but it was just lovely to see. It was just lovely to see Ricky Hatton on top of the world again, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd like to see them competing over here. There must be some pretty appealing fights at the weight as well.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Okay, what else can we talk about? What have we?
We've got Broner coming up on Saturday.
Okay, I mean, I'm presuming that you love Adrian Broner, John.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I genuinely don't know even what to think about him. Before all his recent fights, he says, I'm different, I've changed, I've matured. But has he? And he's asked for this fight. This fight, I think, had been made at £142, maybe, or something like that, and he's asked for it to be moved to £147. I don't know. I think he's maybe an annoying character, but he does seem a troubled chap as well.
It's ridiculous to say he's a four-weight world champion.
You said it, pal.
It's a little bit sad as well to say that when you can't. I remember, I think it was Thomas Hearns who, I think, became the first four-weight world champion, and it was a tremendous achievement. And kind of since then, due to the dilution of world titles, then more and more people have achieved that. But for Adrian Broner, but are we being too down on him, Adrian Broner? There was very much, for a while, certainly when he was at lightweight, and some of his performances there, it was that this guy is exceptionally special. But can you be a four-weight world champion and still be an underachiever?
Yeah, it's a weird one in that he is underachieving for the sort of, you know, sort of for what we thought he would be capable of doing. You know, for someone who was meant to, at one point was meant to be the next Floyd Mayweather, who calls himself, his nickname is what, about Billions? He's not going to be making billions the way he's carrying on. Well, no, he's never going to make a billion. That's quite a lot of money.
It's loads, that is. That is loads. 27 years old. I mean, I remember when he lost to Marcus Maidana. And there was, you know, he did that. I mean, in fairness to him, I mean, it was a huge upset at the time. But in fairness to him, he did show guts. He showed his fighting spirit in that contest. And the kind of the one plus you could take from that was, okay, well, maybe this is a wake-up call from him. I think certainly in recent boxing history, we put too much pressure on unbeaten records. They're too important. I think very much a fighter can become a much better fighter if he's allowed to develop from a loss. So you kind of thought, well, okay, will Broner now come back and will he be the fighter that we thought, a bit of a kick up the backside for him? But it doesn't really seem to be the case, does it? At 27 years old, though, John, can he go on to become what we would, that he might be classed as a great in the future?
I mean, it's hard to write someone off. I think he can still go on to have an exceptional career, but I don't think he's going to be a great fighter, as in someone with like defining classic wins. And it's just he's shown grit in his fights as well as his skill. But then it's but it's between fights outside of the ring as well. He's getting in trouble. He hasn't settled in his right weight division. I'm not sure. He's probably not best off at welterweight as well. And it's just that sort of wayward nature. It's getting increasingly late in his career to, to change the habits of a lifetime.
27 years old, though.
The years have not been kind to him, I would say.
He does. Certainly when he's out the ring, he looks a lot older and he doesn't look after himself.
Yeah.
So it's difficult. It's certainly difficult to predict a future for him where he will have lived up to the potential expectation, perhaps.
Because what are the super fights for him? Is it getting? I don't think he wouldn't beat Manny Pacquiao.
Well, I don't know. I think that could be. I mean, Manny Pacquiao, what, 39 years old now, or approaching 39 years old? Potentially, he might beat that version of Manny Pacquiao. But I genuinely don't think Broner, at this moment in time, and unless something changes, any moment in time, is a big enough name, a worthy enough talent to make up one half of a super fight.
Alright,
so
that's how it is. He could lose this fight.
And that was my next question. Adrian Granados El Tigre. So what are we expecting from Granados? What chance the upset?
I think pretty good. He seems extremely motivated. The thoughts were that he could sort of replicate what Marcus Maidana did.
Yeah.
Granados is saying he's a different style. He sparred with Broner, so there's respect, but also familiarity there. So I think I'd probably tip Broner to win, but then I always do, and Broner manages to lose fights.
But I mean, I think this is an indication of Broner's standing and of his reputation at the moment. If you were to watch this fight and Granados was to win, it isn't going to your jaw isn't going to be hitting the floor in shock, is it? It'll be like, oh, right, no. Okay.
Or is it Broner could show up and be on it and like outbox him?
Yeah.
Or he could just be outworked.
But if
out hustled and out muscled.
But if someone of the stature that Broner thinks he's at, like a Pacquiao, was to lose to Granados, you'd be quite shocked, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's point well made.
If you say so yourself. What else is on your mind, Matt?
What else is on my mind? Well, we've got in this, I mean, I'm not just saying this because I conducted the interview, but we've got a massive...
It's jolly good.
We've got a massive interview in this week's issue with Jeff Fenech. I can't claim that it's particularly well written because it is simply just a Q&A. But I don't think... I mean, to kind of put this into context, I was out at the WBC convention in December... And Jeff Fenech was one of the guys that I wanted to sit down with. I was a huge fan of his back in his heyday. Tremendous fighter, furious, talented, who made ridiculous progress. I mean, he turned professional within 196 days of him turning professional. He was world champion. And he kind of came from nowhere, really. He was at the Olympics, but he didn't really make a name for himself there. There was a bit of buzz about him over in Australia, but on the world scene, not really. And then he just started. He went through all these wonderful performances. But he was kind of over in Australia. Now, what should have been his defining performance? I think it was in 1991 in Las Vegas. His American debut, his Las Vegas debut, was against the brilliant, the legendary Azuma Nelson, the Professor. And quite clearly, he was robbed. It was a dreadful, dreadful decision. Now, there's controversial decisions where you will find people that will say, I can see why they gave it to him. But with this, almost 100% of people were like, that is awful. Jeff Fennec dominated that fight. Now, that was 26 years ago. And I made the mistake, or the right call, some might say, from what followed, of bringing up that fight with him. And we sat and we spoke for about 40 minutes, and he was quite literally spitting angry. And it's one of the most unbelievable interviews I've ever conducted, with the fury that was there. But it also shows you why he was such a special fighter. There's quite a lot of expletives. It did cross my mind that perhaps I could have got rid of a few of those, so not to be quite as offensive. But ultimately, these are coming out of his mouth. It shows what kind of character he is, how very, very passionate he still is about being on the wrong end of that decision.
There are a lot of asterisks here.
There is, so. but it is. I mean, but his opinion on officials. He's got some choice words as well for Andy Ruiz and Joseph Parker. He speaks in depth about his time, his brief stint as Mike Tyson's trainer, right at the end of Mike Tyson's career. He talks about his proudest moments. Why he came back in 2008 for that rubber match against Azuma Nelson, and some of the things he's really, really not ashamed of, is when he got launched into superstardom at a very young age, and he speaks there, and he kind of opens up that he's really not proud of the way that he behaved there. I mean, one thing he was saying in the lead up to the Nelson rematch is that he was sleeping with 5 different girls a day. I mean, lucky old Jeff Fennec. Can you imagine that? I mean,
sounds very tiring.
So yeah, I mean, if you give it a read. I mean, we're all obviously very proud of every issue of Boxing News, but this one is particularly packed. There's a huge feature as well. I mean, people, we kind of get. No, you love because we've got Kell Brook on the front cover. I mean, on the front cover of a magazine. What were we thinking? Putting an eye-catching image, an eye-catching headline, on the front of a magazine that's on the newsstand that needs to sell. What were we thinking doing that? I mean, I kind of do wonder sometimes if the kind of the editors of 442, when they put a big name, one of the biggest names in football, on the front cover, and then they put a relatively complimentary headline with it, if all the readers of 442 then kind of go berserk, oh, what are you thinking doing that? What are you thinking? But I mean, but as well as kind of giving Kell Brook on the a bit of a tap on the back and saying, well, well done for doing that, we do also investigate the whole pay-per-view boom, the box office boom. Is it a good thing for boxing? Some people will say yes, it is. It's bringing in a lot of interest. But is it also getting rid of a lot of fans? Is it just a short-term measure, short-term get-rich-quick kind of thing? And we look
so
at the
impact. What's the answer?
You have to get this week's issue. You have to get this week's issue. We investigate it. We look at it. And you know, what impact is it having on the sport? It's most certainly not a 100% positive article. I would say it's probably around 45%, but it does ask some questions, and it answers some questions as well.
Well, I'm going to spend this weekend reading Boxing News.
You absolutely should. So what else is there for us to talk about? How long have we been banging on for?
Like 34 minutes and 19 seconds.
Okay, well that's a decent time.
I've barely got a word in. I mean, you've probably blacked out, but it's just been like a 34-minute rant.
Yeah, I do apologise. It's been a while since we've done this, but
if you could see Matt now, you would see the veins.
I look like Jeff Fennec did when I was interviewing him.
You look like the scientist just before he turns into the Incredible Hulk.
That's good.
Just at that moment.
Was it Banner?
I want to say Bruce Banner.
Yeah, Bruce Banner. Do you know what? That moment in The Incredible Hulk, not in the film, but it used to be a TV series that I used to watch when I was a kid.
With Lou.
And that moment where he is going through that change from normal human being into big green muscle-bound mess used to terrify me. His eyes used to change and I used to hide behind the sofa because I just couldn't deal with it. So you must have been scared out of your wits for the last half an hour.
That's why I haven't spoken. it's like a cross between Bruce Banner and... I don't know.
Okay, so sorry if I've been overly vocal. Is there anything you wanted to add?
No.
It's been magical.
Okay, so let's call it a day there. Thank you, everybody, for your continued support to Boxing News. It does genuinely mean the world to us all. And until next time... Bye-bye.